Okay, good. All right, here we go. Welcome, everyone. Good morning. It's Thursday, January 24th. This is Henry Harris, and welcome to another installment of the weekly Amuna Teleforum. We'll do a brief review, and then we're going to jump into today's topic. So the review, the call, what is this call about? The call is about an understanding of Amuna, and in particular, the relevance of that of Amuna to our psychological experience moment to moment. So how does that work? The basic idea is that there really is nothing other than divine thought. Everything is created moment to moment through one single power, and there's only one moment in which it's created, and that's now. So everything, including the table that's in front of me and the chair I'm sitting on and, you know, the air that I'm breathing, it's all what we call the Dvar Hashem. There's no independent existence to it. It's moment to moment to moment being energized and sustained by the Creator. And what's fascinating is that's not only true of the reality of the table and the air, etc. It's also true of the flow of thought that flows through my mind, much of which is not visible to me. The reality of the thoughts that pass through my mind are also a Dvar Hashem. They're also created by the Creator. And we see that referenced by the idea of the simple notion that there's a, the Torah speaks of the Yetzirah, the Torah speaks of the Yetzirah Tov, the Talmud describes how God is Mechadesh, each of those moment to moment. Moment to moment to moment, the Almighty renews this spirit of the spirit of the Yetzirah, the spirit of the Yetzirah Tov, it's flowing through us. And as I like to mention, we see how, I'm just going to do a couple of mutes. We see the reference to this in the notion of our hearts. Our heart, are the two hearts that beat within us, are beating at all times, and they're not a function of my management, my causing them to beat. They're beating. The Almighty is beating my heart. He's pumping these two flows of blood through me at all times. So too, my spiritual consciousness is likened to a heart in that it's pumping continuously, not through my management, not through my efforts, with a flow of thought, that is Yetzer Hara, Yetzer HaTov. That's the way it's flowing. Now, the Almighty tells me in advance, I'm going to pump your consciousness with these two flows of thought. And what I'm asking you to do is to serve me with both. Serve me with both of these these flows of consciousness. Now, it's very helpful to know and appreciate that the flow of consciousness is not coming from the world out there. That's really where this starts to get exciting and highly relevant, is that my experience of life is coming from the gift of divine thought in this moment. What's the alternative? That it's coming from some circumstance or some reality in the world. A common set of circumstances that we might associate with causes of our experience would be people in our lives, would be circumstances in our lives. It could be bosses, it could be colleagues, it could be spouses, it could be children, it could be a variety of things. Another very big circumstance that we tend to associate as a power, as an independent power, is our own, is ourselves. Like we're powerful. We're the cause of our experience, whereby if I have a negative habit, it looks to me like there's something problematic about me. There's something broken or flawed about my character that is the problem, as opposed to divine thought, as opposed to the flow of divine thought that every human being is subject to, whether he's, and it's not a reflection on his broken qualities or his poor character. It's not personal. Each one of us flows as the Torah promises us, as God promises us. We will each flow with these two modes of consciousness, and our job is to understand what's true about them, and thereby navigate our lives with truth, as opposed to confusion. What's the confusion? The confusion would be idolatry. Idolatry is the premise that there is an alternative power to the single source. There is something real that is cause of anything in this world. So given the example that we're talking about in terms of our psychological experience, I shared with you not long ago the story of a gentleman who was berating himself. Like he said of himself, he was with his child, his 7-year-old daughter, at bedtime, and he was consumed by stressful, worried thinking relating to work and other matters. And he said of himself, "I felt like an idiot. I felt like an idiot that I could not somehow release myself from these thinking." So look at the logic behind that assertion. I felt like an idiot. Why? Because I could and should be able to not have these thoughts. Nonsense. There's no person in the world that won't be subject to the flow of insecure thinking at times, to the flow of worry and stress that feels compelling. It feels like a compelling thing. And what do I do? What's the logic behind the idolatry? That, this feeling is telling me about something real. It's telling me about something that is worthy of fixing. It's worthy of, like, it's telling me about my character. It's telling me about my bad habit. It's telling me about my weakness. And I don't like it. I don't want it. I want to get rid of it. Right? So at that moment that he's saying to himself, "I need to get rid of it, I need to deal with it, I need to fix it in some manner," it's based on the logic of there's something here to fix. There's something of this world that is in my purview to deal with and battle, as opposed to this is a flow of thinking that is coming from the divine, that's coming from the divine. And guess what? I am on the receiving end of the divine. There's only one way things work, and that's that we're on the receiving end of the divine. It's like the analogy of the woman in labor. She's not going to fix the contractions. She's not going to delay them or shorten them or stop them. She does have the possibility to understand what's true about them. She does have that possibility, and that's where our free will lie. We, to the best of my understanding, my free will does not lie in banishing negative thoughts, stressful thoughts, worried thoughts. My free will does not lie in summoning good and peaceful thoughts. My free will lies in recognizing the truth about my experience in this moment. And every moment is a mitzvah. Every moment is another opportunity. That means to say that every moment is not, it's there will be new challenges. There will be new opportunities to relearn and revisit this in this moment, because that's the nature of this experience. Is that, you know, we're inclined, if it's a constant commandment not to believe in other gods, not to ascribe power to things other than God, it must mean that there is a temptation to hang our experience on all kinds of things in this world, the people in our lives, the circumstances, our own faulty character. Right? That's what this call is about. This call is about understanding the deeper and simple truth about Emunah, that Emunah is telling us there is nothing other. There is no cause, and therefore I don't seek to be a cause. I don't seek to be a changer, manager, resistor, avoider. I seek to be a truth seeker. That's what I'm interested in. The verse says, I saw this verse recently and it really struck me, Yismach lev mevakshei Hashem. The heart rejoices of the one who seeks the divine. Now notice it says, the heart is going to rejoice of whom? Of the one who seeks the divine. That means it's impossible that you're not going to have joy if you seek the truth. And guess what? The truth, it doesn't say the heart will rejoice of the one who seeks joy. It says the heart will rejoice of the one who seeks truth. Guess what? Truth is no less truthful in a rotten feeling than it is in a nice feeling. The truth is the truth. The heart rejoices of the one who seeks the truth. We're liberated. We're free. We are free from the burden and the responsibility of managing our feeling state, of resisting certain feeling states. We're not on the hook for it. It's not our job. It doesn't work like that. We will not be able to avoid the flow of constricted consciousness and thought, we will not be able to insulate ourselves from the experience of insecure thought. However, there is tremendous, tremendous value any moment that we glimpse the truth of this understanding about what is true about our experience, about, and then simultaneously when we glimpse the truth of what cannot be true, what cannot be true about our experience. Those are huge, huge spiritual accomplishments. Our sages say that there is no end to the merit and the reward and the value of any moment of seeing that truth, independent of the feeling state that it accompanies. Now, guess what? The good news is that the promise that the Torah tells us is that as we become more interested in truth-seeking and less interested in feeling-seeking, it's going to clean up our lives. We're going to have a joyous heart. We are going to become disentangled from all of the ways in which we are not able to navigate our lives, like all the ways that we're trying to resist and manage and avoid the things in our life that look scary to us. Those are all those things are doing are just entangling us in ways in which we're incapable of, right? They're just tangling us in things that are impossible, which Nebuch, you know, ties us down and restricts our consciousness and keeps us in a space of struggle. Pain is normal. It's recurrent pain, chronic pain, that's an indication of misunderstanding. And that's where we move from pain to suffering. So that was my summary. That was a little longer summary than I expected, but that's the summary. And the topic that I spoke of wanting to share this week was how prayer works. You know, how prayer to me is an indispensable part of the inside-out understanding. And I'm going to share with you some sources that are just so moving. I've talked about them in the past. I want to revisit them because they're just so incredible. And I'm going to share with you the first one, which describes how it's a passage from the Talmud in Chulin, and it says as follows. It says Rabbi Asi saw a contradiction in the verses. One verse says that already on the fourth day, the earth brought forth plants. On the third day. While the later verse, which was just before Shabbos, already on the sixth day, said all of the greenery of the field had not yet grown. Right? So third day, the earth brought forth greenery, plants. Sixth day, the greenery of the field had not yet grown. So which was it? So this indicates, the Talmud says, that the plants had germinated, but they didn't yet come out of the ground until Adam was created. Why? To pray for them. There was no one to pray for them, and so they were missing. They were lacking from the world until the prayer of Adam came. And this teaches us that God desires the prayers of his people. So what does that tell you? It tells you that God builds into the world things that are missing. He creates a world in which there's everything in potential. But there's aspects of that potential that's not yet revealed. It's missing. It's missing from the world. And guess what? It's missing in a way that is consequential. Like Adam woke up and looked around and realized, like, there's nothing to eat. You know, I have to eat. I got to help my wife to eat. There's nothing to eat. You know, what am I going to do? Like, huh? That's a problem. You know, God put me in this world. He made me such that I need to eat. And there's no food to eat. Hello, I'm going to die, right? So that's not called a problem. That's called the design of the world. The design of the world is that God places us here with needs, places us in a world that has everything that is available to fulfill our needs, but then withholds those needs. He creates a world in which there is, our needs are lacking. And it's all by design. Why? So that we should notice and say, huh, something is missing from my world. I need it. Let's see. Oh, God is the address for that. God, could you please provide my need? There is nothing more natural in the world than to have a lack And then to see that lack and then acknowledge, okay, the address is God. Now, this to me is so powerful because where does this sit in? Where does this sync with the understanding of, you know, the inside-out understanding? So let's say I'm, you know, experiencing a lack in a relationship, let's say, with one of my kids, right? I'm really annoyed, you know, as I've shared in the past, this happens, and I'm really annoyed. And now I have a choice to make. I can locate the lack. I'm experiencing a lack. How do I know? Because I'm angry or I'm scared or frightened about, you know, him or about whatever. It feels to me that there's something missing, and I notice it because of my emotional agitation. Okay? So there's something missing. So now I'm looking around, and I'm thinking, well, what's missing? So I fixate on him, and I say, he is a problem, right? He lacks this, he lacks that. He's not willing to listen, he's got some broken character, whatever it is, the lack is him. Now at that moment, what I've done is in locating the lack in something in this world, I've lost sight of the whole design of what a lack is for. There is nothing more natural in the world than things lacking. That's what we see from the story of Adam. Nothing more natural than there be things lacking in this world. But there's a job I have to do in order to take that lack and carry it to where it's meant to go, and that's to carry it toward the only address. There's one address in this world for anything, all power, all lacks, all presence, all everything. It's God. So when I locate the lack in my son, I start to tussle with him. I start to try to fix him. I start to resist him. I start to resent him. And then maybe I'll go back on myself. The lack is in me and my parenting. And I get caught up and lost in the whole understanding of what lacks are for. So prayer is simply to close the loop. It's to close the circuit on the missing thing. God made this world with lacks for a reason, so that I should locate the lack in him. Adam was not supposed to say, I don't have the technology, and the reason why there's no produce or food is because I am not smart enough to figure out how to get food out of the ground. Woe is me, I'm no good. That wasn't the point. The point was, well, God is the source of everything. If there's no produce, it means that God is not providing the produce. God, could you please provide produce? That was the goal, right? Bang, that was the whole idea. And it's simple. It's not a complicated thing. But it gets complicated when I misunderstand where lacks are coming from. And obviously behind that is a misunderstanding about where anything comes from. That's why prayer is so, of course, it's natural, as we've described, when a person starts to disentangle from the confusion of outside in, right? When he starts to recognize, wait, it can't be my child or my spouse or my boss. It doesn't work like that. So that alone is going to liberate his GPS, his inner wisdom. It's going to liberate it because it's going to be free to stop worrying about falsehood, right? The sailor that has been shown that there is no flat earth to be worried about falling off of, it's going to liberate his mind from dealing with the flat earth. He doesn't have to strategize how to stop worrying about the flat earth. He just comes to see, there's no flat earth, right? So even though it's true that this understanding is itself a direction, it's transformative, right? If we keep looking in the direction of this truth, we keep affirming the reality of Amunah, we keep affirming the truth of there are no other powers, that itself is going to release wisdom in us. It will. That's going to be, you know, how that's going to be, of course, divine assistance. But prayer is a powerful part of that. Prayer is the insight or the effort that we can make to help ourselves simplify the nature of reality, to see more deeply this simple truth. And I'll share with you another source that is just a couple more sources, and then we'll pause. So the Torah says that Avraham was mispalel el Hashem. Avraham prayed to God. It says that in the book of Bereishis, in chapter 20, verse 17. And on that, the Midrash says that this is the first time in the Torah that the word tefillah, mitpalel, occurs. And what does it mean? When Abraham did hitpalel, when he prayed, the knot was untied. That's the language the Midrash uses, that when Abraham did mitpalel, when he did tefillah, prayer, the knot was untied. Something became uncomplicated. Now, what does that mean? So this is the commentary of the Maharzav on that Midrash. He says, when the Midrash says that the knot was untied, it's associating the word for tefillah with the same expression that that was used when, I can't remember if it was Leah or Rachel, but when one of them, whoever was the mother of Naphtali, said, God has disentangled me, Naphtalti. That Rashi explains is associated with the expression of prayer. I'm sorry, with the expression of disentanglement. So there are other sources that describe to Naphtalti as prayer. So we see two references. Naphtalti is a language of disentanglement, and it's a language of prayer. And now comes the Maharzav and explains, in my humble opinion, both words are correct explanations. Why? When God created man in the world, all things were straight. Asa Elokim esa Adam Yashar. God made man simple and straight. And what happened when man sinned? He entangled the world. They created and introduced a whole set of calculations which worked at odds with that simplicity. The purpose of prayer, says the Maharzav, is to straighten that which is crooked and to disentangle that which is knotted. Prayer, which comes from the root to disentangle, is simultaneously the root for prayer, and because it removes entanglement. And so what does that mean? It means that prayer is the affirmation of there's one address. There's only one address. And I'll tell you for myself where this understanding of Emunah was new in some ways to me was, like, I always had an understanding that Emunah meant that God runs the world, and if he introduces a circumstance to your life, it means it was his plan and for a benefit. So let's say you had a difficult neighbor. Let's say you had an uncomfortable circumstance, or let's say you had a traffic, whatever. It was, the way it looked to me was, this is a painful circumstance, but God arranged it. So obviously God wants me to deal with this hard circumstance, right? That was the way I used to view it. But guess what? Beneath that recognition that God is arranging and choreographing this difficult circumstance was somewhat of an internal protest, but this is really hard. But it's real. It's real that it's hard. It's real that it's upsetting. It's real that this person is a bad person, right? There was, as Keith Blevins likes to describe, there was a mixed paradigm in my understanding of Emunah. There was an awareness of sorts that said, okay, God is exposing me to this, but let's be clear, this person is causing me pain. You know, this person is really causing me pain, and I really wish that they would stop. But okay, God is, right? There was a mixture of understanding. That's a representation of a non-simple experience of a given scenario. Prayer is designed to support and express an utter simplicity that says that, nope, there's only one thing, there's only one source. And even not only is God choreographing the circumstance of this person, whatever, he's the source of my experience of this person or circumstance in this moment. And therefore, when I find myself with some negative habit, which I have negative habits, I have negative thought habits, I have certain thoughts, I have habits of judgmental thinking toward people I'm close to. I have habits of self-judgment. I have various habits. Now, I'm tempted at times to locate those things in the failings of others, the flaws of others. That's a misunderstanding. There's nothing more normal in the world to be lacking something. When I'm struggling with my child or someone else in my life, and I'm revisiting over and over judgmental thinking, critical, negative thinking, And I'm tempted to locate it in his behavior or his failings. It's a misunderstanding that what's going on is I'm having a thought habit. I'm missing the thought, the divine thought that would be helpful to me in being the resource that my child needs. It's true he's struggling, but my pain about his struggle is not coming from him. And as a result, I'm left somewhat impaired in my ability to be of help to him because I'm so judgmental. I'm so critical toward him. People don't get helped by critical people, you know? So what I see is that I'm missing the divine thought that would allow me to see. I'm missing divine thought. It's not personal, but I'm missing it. It's something that I need, and I'm responsible. Just as Adam was responsible to find food for himself and his wife, and he couldn't make it, so he turned to God, so too, I'm responsible to be a loving I'm responsible to be a helpful parent to my child. I am stuck in habitual judgment. I'm not seeing something about this that I keep going back to this judgmental thinking. God, I see that I need your help. So rather than get focused on him, rather get focused on me as sources, I acknowledge you're the source, God. You're the source of this thought, this divine thought. And I'm looking there, and please provide me with new thought. That's how prayer works. That's what I'm seeing that prayer works. And God never tires. One last source, and then I'm going to pause. So it says it says like this. When a person has a friend, the more he asks, this is a sort, this is a midrash. When a person has a friend, the more he asks him for things and borrows from him, the more the friend gets annoyed by him. But this is not true of God. The more a person seeks his needs and petitions him, the more God loves him. God says, call me and I will answer you. God never, ever, ever, ever tires of hearing our requests. He built into this world things missing. He designed those things that we should locate the missing stuff in God and God alone. And then we should then say, God, I'm missing this thing. You're the source. You're the reason why it's missing. Please, I'm turning to you. Help me. And to me, that is such a powerful way to both remind myself of the simplicity, the simple truth, and express in a conscious way my desire for an awareness of that simple truth. Okay, that is my presentation. And I would be very interested to hear okay, you're unmuted, and if you have a thought or a question, I would love to hear. Well, it seems I don't have a thought or a question out there. Although
I'll ask something.
Oh, great! I love it when people ask questions and comments. Yeah.
So basically, whatever happens to us, like we can't judge ourselves and everything like that. But where does it come in that, let's say, we do an avera? So how does that work? Let's say we get a thought about something, and then if we actually do something, then we have to work on ourselves because we did the wrong thing. Like, where does that come in that we actually did an avera? It's
good
once
question.
We do something, like the thought is there and that doesn't work, but once we actually do something, that's when it comes in. Because they always say, like, we're flawed and we have to work on our flaws. So,
right. So,
we weren't flawed in that sense.
Right. So, that's a good question. So, what I would say is that my understanding is that we make mistakes based on a misunderstanding. Like, so, for example, when I become reactive to a child's inappropriate behavior, and I become angry, right? Anger is a mistake, right? It's a nevera. Now, when I, in the moment, I didn't see that, and it just looked overwhelmingly logical and compelling to, you know, to yell or to react. But at some point, I'm going to see that. I'm going to see that I'll be curious about, you know, particularly because I'm fortunate to be aware on some level of how Inside Out works. So at a certain point, I remember, wait, it can't be him, right? It can't be that he's sourcing my experience. So what is it then? What is the experience where did the anger come from? That's when I have an opportunity to recognize I became acquainted with where misunderstanding is present in my life. Hold on, just want to make sure that we're, yeah. So I see that I fell into locating the pain, I got this hit of upset feeling, right? I got a hit of upset feeling in the presence of my son's behavior, and I lashed out. Now, at a certain point, I slow down and I think, well, what happened there? I didn't know how to respond differently, but I can see in retrospect that I was living inside of a logic of idolatry, right? I was living inside of a logic of there is a power out there, and I have no choice but to fight it, resist it, stop it, and that's what led me to react to him. And so I can then, you know, I can say, God, I need help. Like, I am missing understanding about the inside-out nature of this world. I'm missing clarity. The only reason why I did what I did was because of the presence of confusion, the presence of divine thought without clarity. Like, it's two things, okay? It's the thought of, it's the Yetzer Hara thought that shows up in my heart that's like insecure, and it's the misunderstanding about that thought. And that's where I turn to God and I say, look, I can't be the parent I need to be without understanding. It's the only thing accounting for my reactivity to him was my misunderstanding. So God, I need that. I'm doing my tshuva, God, is to acknowledge the source of the mistake. It was my misunderstanding. But I don't have, just like Adam. Adam said, look, the source of my lack of food is that there's no rain. But I'm responsible to see that, God. I'm responsible to see that I'm responsible for food, right? You've put me in a world where I have to take care of myself and care of my wife. I'm responsible for food. But at the same time, I can't bring rain and thereby produce food. So I'm acknowledging my responsibility, and I'm also acknowledging my responsibility to turn to you and say, give me the rain. That's what I'm doing with an avera. I do an avera, I acknowledge that the source is a lack of understanding, and I say, and I'm clear about it, I don't blame my son, and I don't blame my childhood, and I blame one thing. Divine thought in this moment is accounting for my confusion. God, can you please help me have new thought? Does that...
Let's say someone has a thought to eat non-kosher food, and they act on it, and that's their avera.
Right, so of course they have to deal with the action that they did, but if they're interested in avoiding that mistake in the future, it's going to be helpful for them to get to the root of the problem.
The same issue, just realize that they get a thought like that, they don't have to listen to it.
Exactly, that's it. See, the reason why they do kosher problems, or they do Shabbos problems, or they do internet problems, or they do whatever things they do, is because a feeling comes over them. It shakes them, it unsettles them, and they become frightened to the point where they seek refuge from that feeling in what ends up being a forbidden action, right? That's basically what averas are. Averas are, and you know, they're acting out. They're acting out in an attempt to find refuge from an upset feeling. You know, when a guy sits down to learn Gemara, and after a minute he feels himself unable to focus and unable to concentrate, and he feels like he's unsuccessful in learning, so he's tempted to want to shut the Gemara and just go somewhere, right? That's at least my experience, right? So in that moment, he's tempted to say, it's the reason why I'm not able to deal with this is because there's something wrong with me. I'm not a Gemara guy, or I'm not a learner guy, or Gemara learning is just not for everybody, or whatever it is, right? He locates his discomfort in something in this world. And as a result, then he wants to get away from that thing because he doesn't know how to deal with it. So he goes away. It's the same thing when a person eats more food than he needs to eat, or he says Lashon Hara, or whatever it is. It's coming from the misunderstanding of what divine thought is. And that's true for my son as well, who's acting inappropriately. He's experiencing a misunderstanding of divine thought. If I'm just going to match his misunderstanding with misunderstanding, it's not going to, you know, it's not going to help.
Right. I was taught like so differently, so weirdly.
Say again.
I'm just saying we're taught so differently since we're young that it's like just so interesting. Like, right? I'm thinking that everything the other way.
Yeah. Right. Well, we tend to focus on actions, and you know, there is a tempting there, and there's not to say that there isn't can value in dealing with behaviors, but I think we could probably all see that behaviors might or might not get to the heart of the matter. You know, changing behaviors are valuable. Like, for example, I have a tendency to waste time at times on the computer. So I have a filter that allows me to shut down my access to internet at certain times. Is it the case that I need the filter? Isn't it true that if I have understanding, I'm not going to waste time? Because why would a person who's standing in a clarity about life and inside out understanding, why would he wouldn't waste time, right? But at the same time, I kind of know that I know where I'm at presently. I don't, you know, I kind of know that I have insecure, I go in and out of more secure thinking, less secure thinking, and in my insecure moods, I tend to do things that are not helpful to they're not productive. So I help myself in the way that I know to help myself by creating boundaries, by, you know, by behavioral things. But I know that the real deal is in looking to the inside out. And good news, I see that it's changing. You know, I see that my ability to navigate healthy, constructive choices without imposing behavioral, you know, what's the word? Like without managing my behavior, I see that it's going places. You know, I see that, and thank God. But I'm willing and interested to deal with behavior where it's, you know, where it's helpful and it's not, where it's possible. It's just not possible to manage our behavior in every area of our life, as far as I can tell. I can't manage my behavior in every moment of parenting and in every moment of my relationship with my wife and in every moment of everything else that matters to me. I can manage behavior in some areas of my life, and knowing about the inside out is the greatest place to seek the gold.
Right. Okay, thanks.
Sure. Anybody else with a thought or a question? Well, I'll share something that I've been seeing more recently. That is that it's normal for people to be stuck and then to get unstuck and not necessarily understand how they got unstuck. I spoke about that last week, and I saw something additional about that in that, like, I'll give you an example. When I was a teenager first learning to drive, like, I remember sitting in the car for the first time behind the driver's wheel, like a moment or two, a minute or two into the driving lesson in this empty parking lot, I remember what came to mind was, this is impossible. There's no way. There's no way I can do this. That's what came to my mind. Like, I'm sitting in the car, the ignition is on, there's a gas pedal, there's a brake pedal, there's a rear view mirror, there's a side view mirror, there's a signal. There is other things that need to be potentially managed, like windshield wipers, and, you know, and that's all without traffic. Like, all of that is me sitting in an empty parking lot with nothing around, right? It was like, it felt so clear to me, this is impossible. Like, there's no way I'm going to do this. That's what I remember thinking to myself. Now, to the extent that I would listen to that thinking, what's the likelihood that I would take the next step in learning how to drive? Not very high, you know, like that. That emotionally compelling perspective that this is just not possible, it was so real to me. But guess what happened? Somehow or another, the thought came up that said, wait a second, you have dozens of friends who've already done this, and there are billions of people who've done this. That's what came to mind. And so you know what happened? I stopped paying attention to that thought that said, this is impossible. Now, I didn't see that at the time. It wasn't like I understood that. I'm looking back at that, and I'm remembering how I went from, no way, not going to happen, I cannot do this, to, yeah, you just try, you know, just keep at it. And then there was the work, right? Then there was the effort and the work associated with learning to drive. Like, there was practice, there was time, there was... But do you see that when I wasn't looking in the direction of this is impossible, that thought that was so clear and so compelling to me, when I was no longer like giving that real playing time, then I was able to do the work associated with learning things, right? There is effort associated with the life that we're living, but there's a difference between making effort as you're clinging to despairing thought and making effort when you're not clinging to despairing thought. The way that our GPS works, the neshama that God placed within us, this yashrus, this simple wisdom that is like, it just, I learned how to assimilate a lot of information at the same time in a way that became, now it's like, no, you know, obviously I've been driving for a long time now, but even, you know, within weeks I was able to assimilate all that information, and my experience of this is impossible shifted to this is normal, right? That happened because my GPS was present. Well, my GPS was no longer being jammed by the attention to the Yetzer Hara, you know, insecure thinking, right? I had the Yetzer Hara insecure thinking, and then at a certain point I said, like, I don't need to pay attention to that. Now, that was a gift, right? That was a gift that the Almighty reminded me, people do this all the time. Oh, okay, stop paying attention to that. Internally, I just stopped paying attention to it. Now, I have another story for you, which is fascinating, and that is, some of you might have heard of the story of a man named Roger Bannister. Roger Bannister was, I think, an Englishman who lived during the middle of the 20th century, and he was an athlete. He was a runner. And at that time, in the 1950s, no one had yet achieved the accomplishment of running a mile in under 4 minutes. And there were all kinds of people who were convinced, like medical doctors and sports experts, and lots of people were like, yeah, it's just not something that's humanly possible, right? It's physiologically, medically, a human being is not designed to cover that amount of ground in less than a certain amount of time. It's just not possible. The same way that a human being can't jump to the moon, a human being can't run a mile in 4 minutes. That's what people were saying. And then guess what? Roger Bannister ran a mile in less than 4 minutes. I don't remember the details, if it was within 12 months or if it was within 6 months, but within like months after Roger Bannister having broken the 4 minute mile, like a dozen or 19 or whatever, some big number of people ran the mile within 4 minutes. Why? My understanding is that because they had reason to no longer listen to the voice that said, can't do it, it's a circumstantially fixed thing. Human beings, 4 minutes, nope, can't work. It's a physical reality. It's a circumstantial truth, right? That is what is the nature of our, you know, that's just the limits. So when people stopped paying attention to that, bang, their GPS led them to go elsewhere. Now, the exciting thing to me in this is that when I understand what's true about that logic, right, the logic behind my going from stuck and driving to unstuck, the logic that went from stuck people running under 4 minute mile to unstuck people running under 4 minute miles, the logic was that they were able to take their mind, they were able to look away, they were able to appreciate that what happened was they got insight. They were able to let go of they were able to stop paying attention to the limiting thinking. Well, if that's true, then I don't need to wait for a Roger Bannister to show up in my life and show how I can navigate my parenting situation with a different approach, or how he can navigate, you know, Roger Bannister to show up and navigate my parenting experience with a different approach. I don't need to discover that billions of people parent differently or go about marriage differently or deal with their own internal negativity. I don't need to wait for all of those external evidence or proof. I can simply acknowledge that how human it is. What's happening in those circumstances is that people came to, when they came to recognize that there was less reason to really attend to that limiting thinking, to that insecure thought. Like, they could have the insecure thought, but they could just say, okay, that's insecure thought, like, it's possible. Then their GPS just woke up and they found their way. That's happening all the time in my life already. I might not notice and understand that that's what's happening, but once I understand that that's the logic, I can realize it's replicable in every place in my life. I see that where I recognize that there is the presence of insecure thought, the presence of this divine flow of insecure thought, and I pay attention to it through innocent misunderstanding, right? It's only innocent misunderstanding. That is the only thing that inhibits my navigating my life. It's the only thing that keeps me from breaking the 4 minute mile, or from learning to drive, or from learning to parent with equilibrium. It's the only thing, is the fact that I am paying attention to somewhat invisible negative thought. Like, it doesn't look visible to me. It looks like it's my child's behavior. It looks like it's my own, you know, character flaw, etc. That's it. That's the only reason why I don't break the 4 minute mile. And that allows me to kind of appreciate just how human this design is, that we get stuck. We can see what's true about our stuckness, and then bang, our GPS wakes up and starts to see new things. Okay, I'm stopping here to pause, and I'm looking forward to possible comments or questions. Okay, well, I just want to remind everybody how much I enjoy the opportunity to share this, how much I enjoy the opportunity to interact in this conversation, and just how valuable it is. This is like we were put in this world for as long as we were put in this world, if it's, you know, God willing, 120 years for each one of us. And what's fascinating to me is that this understanding is an accomplishment every moment we wake up to it, which means that it's a challenge every moment. It's a challenge. If it weren't a challenge, there would not be a commandment. A commandment assumes an opportunity and a challenge. There is a continuous moment-to-moment challenge and commandment to remember or to acknowledge that I'm living in the experience of divine thought, that there is one and only source to everything, including my psychological experience. And there is, in every moment, the temptation and the challenge to locate my experience in something other than God. Those things can be commonly, like I've shared, the people and the circumstances. And a big, big thing that I associate my experience with is me. That I'm the source of my experience. It's my flawed character. It's my imperfect nature. It's my brokenness of whatever kind. No, I have places in my life where I have a habit of there is divine thought of an insecure nature showing up, and I have yet to see something deeper about that insecure thought, the nature of thought. That's all. I have a habit of divine thought, and I haven't seen it. I have a habit of judgmental thought. I have a habit of insecure thought, and I haven't seen something about it yet. But I'm going to tell the truth about it. I'm going to tell the truth that it's not my spouse, it's not my child, it's not, even if they are doing things that are inappropriate, it could very well be that they are. But my experience of their behaviors is not coming from their behaviors, right? There's an option, there's the possibility of anger, there's a possibility of compassion. That feeling state is telling me about my understanding or the lack of understanding. And as we said at the beginning, you know, what I was looking to share about prayer, there's nothing more natural in the world than things being lacking from this world. God designed the world that there will be lacks, and that he designed the world that we have the choice to locate that lack in him, or not in him, God forbid, that he's lacking, but that he's the source of it. He's the source of there being no rain. He's the source of my Yetzer Hara thinking. And now I have the choice to turn to him, to acknowledge and to close the circuit. And just one last quote that is kind of a repetition of what it's a repetition of the idea I shared before, like how much God's waiting for our prayers, how much he's placing lacks in our lives, lacks of understanding, that should be an impetus to turn to him. It says here, cast your burden, that says in Tehillim, cast your burden upon God and he will sustain you. So the Midrash says, if a human being has a helper and he goes to him once, he's received. The second time he's also received. But the third time, he's refused an audience. By the fourth time, no attention is paid to him at all. Now, this is, you know, kind of human nature. This is not true of God, says the Midrash. No matter how many times you bother him, he receives you. And further, it says more than that. Wait. It says... there is nothing sought by God except to hear the prayers of the Jewish people. That means every time I have an insecure feeling, I can acknowledge, I'm missing understanding, God. Can you help me? It's like being in the contraction, you know? It's like being in the contraction. It hurts. It's from you. Can you help me to gain understanding about this? Can you help me to deliver me to a different place? He is, the whole design of this lack is to turn our eyes toward the source of the lack, and he loves that. So, I don't have anything else to share. And again, I want to thank you. If you are interested, I always say, please send me a comment or a message at info@JewishCenterForWellbeing.com or at 845-393-1529. And I wish everyone a wonderful week and a good Shabbos.